Ireland may be a small island on the edge of a continent, but our unique mix of animals and plants gives us a fascinating natural history. This series celebrates the animals that share our island, and we meet some of the people who know them best. I'm Colin Stackard-Johnson, and this is Nature on One. This week, I'm exploring the Burren. It's a truly unique landscape that attracts botanists, geographers and archaeologists from all over the world. And I want to look at what makes it so special for wildlife. How on first sight, the Burren looks so barren, yet so many different flowering plants can grow here. And they in turn attract some of our rarest bumblebees. It's midsummer and I'm at Slieve Carron Nature Reserve, just north of the village of Carron in County Clare, and as part of the Burren National Park. Slieve Carron is about 330 metres high and it dominates the surrounding land. Now, the cliff face of the mountain in front of me is known as Eagle's Rock, as it was once a nesting place for golden eagles before they became extinct here over 100 years ago. The Burren, from the Irish Burren, means rocky place, and that's about all you can see from where I'm standing now. Mile upon mile of this sort of lunar landscape, just this vast tablet of exposed limestone. Just the odd patch of hazel scrub and the odd plant peeking up out of a grike. I've met up with Brendan Dunford, who's the project manager with the Burren Farming for Conservation programme, and he's passionate about the Burren and its wildlife. So Brendan, how come there's such a great diversity of plant life here?
Yeah, I suppose there's a number of factors. One is the fact that this is actually a very stressful environment for plants, not just for people, but for plants as well, because you have this huge tablet of limestone and it's covered by a very thin skin of soil. Now you have a high level of rainfall here, maybe a metre and a half per annum. So what happens is a lot of the nutrients are washed out of that very thin skin of soil. So it's a very hard place for competitive plants to survive, by which I mean grasses and buttercups and daisies, which like a lot of nutrients and a bit of disturbance. They don't do very well here. There's not enough nutrients. Combined with the fact that on a very dry summer here, I wish there was one, but in a very dry summer here, the vegetation can burn off very quickly with drought. So you have to be a very particular type of plant to survive here. So a lot of small, compact plants can survive very, very well here in good diversity. Because they're not competing with these richer, stronger plants like the grasses that I described before. I think the other aspect of it here is that there's very little fertilizer application, there's very little disturbance in that regard, so it's very natural growing environment for plants. Those two factors, the climate, the landscape, and also the farming practices, the winter grazing system, which, ensure there's no damage being done to plants during summertime, that also contributes to the huge diversity that you get here. So I remember doing some quadrats here, taking some vegetation samples in the past, and on average, in 1 square metre of burn grassland, you're likely to find over 30 plants, which is incredible. And this is done over thousands of quadrats, but the average number of plants that you find in per square metre would be 30. Now, if you go into a silage field or a normal pasture from the 40 shades of green that we love in Ireland, you're likely to find maybe a dozen plants.
If you're lucky. Or two.
So we're certainly blessed with a huge diversity here because of those factors.
What sorts of plants are common here that you wouldn't find other places so much here?
I suppose a lot of people think that there's all these incredibly rare plants found in the Burren, but it's not really that. I think what's special about the Burren flora is that there's a profusion of plants here that you'll find not too commonly elsewhere. We have a huge range of plants here throughout the year. So at the different times of the year, you'll find different plants. The orchids are a real feature. They're what people look for here. I think there's a wonderful Mediterranean orchid called the dense-flowered orchid, which you'll find here in May and June. You'll find the lovely bee orchid and the fly orchid, the butterfly orchid as well. You'll find wonderful plants like the spring gentian, and later on in the year, the field gentian and the autumn gentian are in flower. You'll find wonderful wetland plants where there's outcropping areas of wet grassland, like butterwort, which is an insectivorous plant. One of my favourite plants is the grass of Parnassus, which isn't a grass at all. It's a beautiful white flowering plant with translucent leaves. Beautiful, beautiful plant. And then you'll find a wonderful range of I suppose, heathy or acid-loving plants which grow in little sections of the burn as well. So it's not just limestone plants. You'll find wonderful acidic plants as well in certain parts of the burn. And what's lovely as well, I suppose, about the plants is that a lot of the plants here have a story behind them. Some of them are used for cures, like the hypericum, which was used for against depression.
St. John's Wort,
yeah. You'll find different plants like Achillea, which is yarrow, which is used as a cure against arthritis in the past. You'll find fairy flax, which is a purgatorial plant, so if you're constipated, you know where to go. You'll find wonderful plants like the quaking grass, which is known locally as the famine grass, or fair gorta. And we're told, folklore has it, that this grass grows where people from the famine died. So it grows up on the bones of where the people died in the famine. And as you walk across it, because it's quite common in the burn, you'll feel the pangs of hunger coming up from the ground into your stomach because of the fair gorta. But if you carry a hazelnut in your pocket, you won't get the hunger pangs. But I keep meeting farmers from the burn. The older farmers will always say to me, I had to come down off the mountain today. I got the fair gorta. I got the weakness. I had to come down off the mountain. So it's a good excuse not to do the work.
Now, all these wonderful flowering plants attract all sorts of insects, and hence insect enthusiasts. Dr. Jane Stout is a lecturer in the School of Natural Sciences at Trinity College in Dublin. She's an ecologist, but her research looks mostly at the interactions between pollinating insects and plants.
I've always heard, you know, the burn is such a great place for bees, and I guess because there are so many fields of flowers and long flowering seasons, but how many of Ireland's bees are found? I mean, how many bees do we have in Ireland? How many of them are found here?
We have 100 species of bee in Ireland, so that breaks down as to 20 social species, the bumblebees, one honeybee species, which most people would be familiar with, and then the rest of the remaining 80 are solitary bees. So they're called solitary because the female founds and provisions a nest without rearing workers, as the social bees do. Of the bumblebees, certainly the burn would be a stronghold for some of our rarest bumblebee species. So the great yellow bumblebee and the shrill carder bee in particular are very rare, not only in Ireland, also in Britain. But the burn would be one part of their range where we see more than we see anywhere else. That's not saying that there's loads of them. You know, I've looked several times in the burn and not seen them, so it's not that you're tripping over them, but they are more common here than they are anywhere else. So the burn seems to be a good place for bees, and largely because of the low intensity farming.
It's great to come to a place where, you know, farming intensity is low, and to see all these fields of wildflowers. I mean, I grew up in Dublin. We had brilliant wildflower fields within 5 or 6 miles of Dublin city centre. We even used to hear corncrakes calling there. And it's just that sort of extinction has been almost a silent extinction, that people haven't notice the change in the land, or how a field has turned from essentially what was a wildflower meadow into maybe just one or two species of grass now.
Yeah.
And people sometimes wonder, well, why aren't the bees around? And say, well, look at that field.
Yeah.
There's nothing there for them to feed on anymore.
And certainly coming across today from Dublin, you know, getting over here and seeing not just the fields, but the verges full of wildflowers. You know, they've not been cut or tidied or sprayed as they are, you know, in a lot of the habitats around Dublin, and you know, in other urbanised parts of the country, and where there's intensive agriculture and there's very intense management, then you lose all these wildflowers. And like you say, it's a bit of a no-brainer when you say, where have the bees gone? Well, there's nothing for them here anymore.
You mentioned something earlier, tongue length.
Mm-hmm.
So different species of bumblebee will have different lengths of tongues, and hence that allows them to exploit different flowers.
That's right. So the longest tongued bee, is the garden bumblebee, has a body length of between sort of 11 and 16 millimetres and a tongue length of about 13. So its tongue is near enough as long as its body, so very, very long tongues. So that means that they can reach down into these long-tubed flowers, like things like honeysuckle, where the nectar is at the end of a long tube, and foxgloves as well, and they can extract the nectar from there.
So now, how do you actually go about measuring a bumblebee's tongue?
Okay, well, the bumblebee's tongue, the bumblebee's mouth parts are sort of adapted for feeding on liquids. So part of the mouth is adapted, and the tongue's like a tube through which it can suck the nectar. So to measure the tongue, then you need to extend the tongue. So it means gently pulling the tongue out with forceps, and then measuring with calipers. Crazy, huh?
You scientists, particularly you sort of bug scientists, do crazy things, that's for sure.
No, that's not the half of it.
And was there a day when you thought, now when I grow up, I'm going to go and I'm going to get a job measuring bees' tongues? Was this a moment in your life, like a Damascus sort of moment?
No. When I was a kid, I hated bees. I hated all sorts of flying insects that buzzed. I worked for a summer in the university where I did my primary degree on butterfly behaviour. We just got started looking at the bees and, you know, just fell in love with them. They're so cute. They're bright colours. They're so docile, so hardworking. They're great things.
Why are they hairy?
Why are they hairy? They are hairy. You find bumblebees all over the world, but mostly in the northern and Arctic areas. So they're a cold adapted insect species. So you don't get them as much in the south of Europe. They're definitely in northern European and northern temperate hemisphere group. So when the queen emerges in the spring, it can often be still quite cold. So that the hairs are for insulation, they're to keep the bees warm. Bumblebees are also quite interesting compared to a lot of other insects because they have the ability to generate heat internally. So like mammals like us, we can control our body temperature and generate heat internally. Bumblebees can do that to a limited extent as well, and so that's why even on relatively cool days you still see, you know, you might not see any other insects, but you'll see bumblebees. And also that means they can come out early in the morning and they can carry on foraging late in the evening, because they have this ability to generate heat, and also the nice furry bodies. It's also why on a really hot day, sometimes if we get really hot days occasionally, you don't see so many bumblebees. You know, it can get too hot for bumblebees.
So now, this looks to me like perfect bee habitat, lots of flowers.
Particularly the red clover there, you can see the quite a lot of red clover here. That's great bee fodder, especially the long-tongued bees like the red clover. We see quite a few of the common species, the common bee species here, but also some of the rarer ones. We've also got some knapweeds over here just coming into flower. Knapweed's an important summer resource for the bees. They also actually love brambles, so even though many other people don't, the bees love it. It produces quite a lot of nectar.
Well, shall we see if we can find one with your net and your jam jar? You know what we used to do? Oh, I shouldn't really say. As kids, you see, boys will be boys, you know what I mean? I'll probably be giving people ideas. I know it's not a good idea. Definitely don't find this at home. But there used to be a dare game. And she would get a bumblebee and put it in a jar. Okay? Now, we weren't harming the bees. Let me say, no bees were harmed in the playing of this game. But you had to listen to them. You had to take off the lid of the jam jar and put it up to your ear. And you had this amazing bzzz. And in all the times I did it, never got stuck.
Yeah, there you go.
But I wouldn't do it.
I wouldn't do it, no.
Wouldn't do it now, but then don't we get boring as we get older? We stop doing all those fun things. Oh, there's one.
There's one over there now, one of the...
A white bottom. No, you don't call
tail.
Them white bottom.
White tailed.
I always get that mixed up.
Catch this without... Did you hear that ever so slightly different buzz? That what it's doing there is it's vibrating the anthers of the flower in order to release the pollen, and some flowers keep their pollen in these anthers that can only be released by bumblebees. So what she's doing is she's going into the flower, doing that little buzz to release the pollen. You can actually almost see a little waft of pollen coming out, and then she's climbing around to the outside of the flower where she's getting the nectar from the bottom of the flower tube.
How does she make that high-pitched vibration?
She holds on to the flower and vibrates her thoracic, the wing muscles, at a particular high frequency. and that just vibrates the flower exactly the right frequency to release the pollen.
That is amazing. You know, sometimes when you see a bee, it comes buzzing around your head.
Oh, yeah.
What's going on there?
She's orientating herself. So quite often when they first leave the nest, when the first time they leave their nest, they'll fly in a zigzag pattern around the nest entrance to familiarise themselves with exactly where the nest is, so that once they come back from foraging, they can find it again. So they move away from the nest in ever-increasing zigzag pattern, and so when they come and fly in your face, it's because they don't expect to see you there, and so they're kind of, you know, checking you out. And they can fly very close to your face, but if you just stand still, they won't attack you. They'll leave you alone and fly off. So here I've got a bumblebee in the net here. You can hear the cross noise it's making because it's trying to get out. I actually think it's a male bee. It's got a little yellow face, little yellow hairs on its face, and it hasn't stung me yet. but the tricky bit with the females, obviously, is you need to get them in a pot without them stinging you, and that involves getting the jar into the net and then getting the bee into the jar. And you can see it's fairly cross.
Can I have a look at him?
He doesn't have the pollen baskets. At least I think it's a he.
Well, no, you could test it by cupping him in your hands.
I could, couldn't I? If I was brave enough, if I had enough confidence in my identification, I would.
Do I have confidence in your identification?
No, because if you get stung, I feel terrible.
I'll feel worse.
the females have a kind of a flat back leg with these long hairs, which is where they store the pollen. This one doesn't have that, so I'm fairly certain this is a male. I think this is a male of one of the common species, Bombus leucorum.
Bombus leucorum is a great name.
The white-tailed bumblebee.
I'd never guessed.
There's a white tail. It has these two yellow stripes, one just behind the head and one on the top part of the abdomen. And then the yellow hairs on the face.
So if I was to put him in my hands, he wouldn't sting me.
Go on. Do you want to prove me wrong?
Oh, no, he's on my hand. Look, I'll try him there first.
If there was a female, then one of the first things she would try and do would be to defend herself and sting. So the fact you haven't been stung yet, I think, means I was right.
They really do vibrate.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely sound. Now, you see the way it's... What's it doing there? Like, is it moving its little backside up and down?
That's grooming. They're either... you see it's wiping its legs across its abdomen. A lot of insects will do that when they're distressed. They'll groom. Or it could just be cleaning himself where he's been covered in dust or pollen or whatever when he's out and about. But it might just be cross.
It's a great way to look at them. Well, I suppose we don't want to hold them for too long. We don't want to get them stressed. Oh, now you can look at them face on. Big eyes.
Yeah, so
lovely. Shall we let him go?
We should.
Here you go, little guy. I love that sound of them flying off.
Yeah. That's what you get when you're out and about, isn't it? Is that just that sound of them getting past you? Yeah.
It's a sound of summer.
It is. Sunny gardens.
Brendan, can you tell me about the Burren Farming for Conservation project?
Well, the Burren Farming for Conservation program is a really terrific, I suppose, new approach to the management of our heritage and our landscape. I'm delighted to say that the Burren is leading the way, I think, in this regard. What it is again, it's a recognition that people are a great resource. The local farming community, especially, who have been here for thousands of years, have a great passion for their place, and giving them the support and giving them the resources to, I suppose, play that role to optimum effect is what the Burren Farming for Conservation programme tries to do. So we have 150 farmers who are part of this programme. This would cover maybe one quarter or one third of the Burren landscape, so it's quite extensive. And what we do is very simple. We basically treat each one of these farmers as an individual and his farm as a separate entity. We ask the farmer, well, what do you think you should do as an expert for generations on this land? What do you think you need to do to improve the condition of the land, to improve the grazing, to offset the scrub encroachment, to keep the water clean? And the farmer comes up with a number of proposals. So it's very much farmer-led. The second thing we do is we transform that information into a very simple farm plan. A one-page farm plan, not 30, 40 pages of tables and texts and numbers and all that sort of thing, which would bamboozle anybody, but a very simple one-page farm plan, which outlines the jobs that we want the farmer to do that year. Now, they have to give environmental value and they have to give value for money before we'll insert them into the farm plan. But if they do that, we'll put them into the farm plan and the farmer then goes ahead and carries out those works which he's nominated or he or she has nominated to do. If the farmer does the work, we pay him or her. If they don't, we don't pay them. So it's very much value for money. The second thing that we do, which is really innovative about this programme, is we pay for results. So we go and assess a farmer's land during the summertime. We look at the biodiversity. We look at the condition of the water sources. We look at the level of scrub encroachment, the number of weeds, the damage that's been done, or the good management. And we give each field a score out of 10. The better the management, the higher the score. The higher the score, the more the money. So the farmers are rewarded for the biodiversity value of his land. If a farmer chooses to graze his land with elephants or giraffes or rhinoceros or whatever he wants during the summer, we don't care. If we come back in summertime and he's got the orchids and the gentians, and if his water supplies, the springs, aren't being damaged, we'll give him a high score, 9 or 10 out of 10. Then he'll get up to €120 per hectare of that land, which if you have a 10-hectare field can mean €1,200 or more. If on the same field the farmer has put far too many stock in, he's fed them with the wrong system, maybe silage or whatever, he's overstocked, he's damaging the water supplies, we'll give that field a score of 0 out of 10. And instead of €1,200, the farmer gets nothing. So it's a very nice system because the farmer can do whatever he wants. The second thing which is good about it is that it's guaranteed value for money for the taxpayer, because if we don't get the biodiversity, we don't pay. Very simple. For a very modest sum, we have a budget of €1 million per annum, which is having a huge environmental impact on the water quality of the burn, on the biodiversity of the burn, the landscape and the archaeology as well.
Pat Nagel from Cora Finn is one of the farmers in Brendan's project.
Pat, you're part of this burn farming for conservation project.
Yes, I am. We're actually delighted to be involved in it. Absolutely thrilled. I couldn't speak highly of the programme. Two reasons. Tis our programme, and tis the burn, and tis something we love doing ourselves. Because if you go back for years, that's what the old people done. They cut the bushes, they maintain the land, maintain the walls. Good farming practice. And it's more environmentally friendlier than any scheme. We've the best of both worlds now. And as Brendan will tell you, it's your scheme. You decide you cut the bushes. You decide you want water or want a wall built. Let's say a son of mine out there, he done three different jobs. He cut bushes in the lower land. He improved the water and truck in the middle of it. And in the top of it, in where there was old shelter walls, they were built and done through the programme. And we're absolutely thrilled about it. Things that we should have done ourselves, but weren't done.
You've been sort of born and reared here all your life, and I know sometimes when you're sort of from a place again, people often say to me, oh well, I don't really appreciate it because I'm from here. But do you appreciate this landscape?
Oh God, of course. I'm passionate actually about the burn. I think it's a fabulous place to live, a fabulous place to travel through, and most of all to farm, because of its terrain. And if you see it at different times, I travel, let's say, 12 miles, 12 to 15 miles, depending on the route I take. And if you see the difference in the, when the sun is out, maybe not so as often as we'd like to see it, but between the sun and the rain, and the way it blends into the rocks or to the cliffs, let's say, here behind us, the landscape. I mean, where would you get the like of it? We talk of Killarney. I think we've Killarney at home. This is fabulous.
Burren Bio is a landscape charity created to foster greater appreciation and knowledge of the burren through education, conservation and research. Now, they've set up an eco-bio course, and 13-year-old Jack McGann from Bell Harbour on the Clare coastline is a recent graduate.
Jack, have you studied much? I know you said recently you completed this course. What was that called?
Ecobio.
Ecobio. And how long was that?
It was 20 weeks from late February to June, so.
20 weeks?
Yeah.
And so what did you go through on that course and who taught you?
We went through flora and fauna with Bridget Berry, and then we went with archaeology with Zina Huchter and Eugene Lamb. She taught us culture and music in the burn, and that's it.
And how much did you know about the burn before you started the course?
Well, not as much as I did afterwards, but I knew the basics, but I learned a lot about the orchids and flora and fauna, so.
Great. And have you got any favourite plant or animals now?
Yeah, my favourite plant, I would like the bee orchid. They're very rare to see. And then my favourite animal would be the pine marten.
Most lads your age, I suppose, are spending maybe too much time watching television, playing computer games. But you like coming out and wandering about in places like this.
Yeah, there's cat's paws and everything. There's orchids, bee orchids, fly orchids, bloody cranesvilles.
No need for bad language.
Yeah, it's the only time we get to say something bad in class.
So imagine now you've got someone, say, they've never heard of the burn, right?
Yeah.
They might never have heard of Ireland. And believe me, people like that exist. How would you describe this landscape to someone?
Well, you would you'd have to explain to them like it's a very barren landscape, but they'd think, and then you have to bring them out to the very backs of the burn just to see like its full nature and beauty and everything. See all the flowers and the plants and animals. They just see a glance on a postcard or something. It's so much more behind it. Like, you're proud to be like Irish once you've experienced this place, and you learn about its history and your ancestors and everything. You know, you just feel filled with pride and everything. So you're truly proud to be Irish. So.